Alright, g'day Navicastrians. A little short episode just being released today. As promised on the longer episode that we did at the beginning of the week, I've managed to line up a chat with our good mate and overseas journalist, freelance journalist, John Davidson. Johnny, thanks for joining us, mate. Really appreciate it.
No problem at all.
Now, we wanted to get you on because, mate, you've been on the ground, boots on the ground over in Russia for the Confeds Cup. So we thought we were going to talk about it during the other podcast episode, but we spent a little bit of time talking about all the other stuff. So we thought it'd be best to get the information straight from the horse's mouth, as it were. So you went over to Russia for the last two games of the Socceroos in the Confeds Cup, Cameroon at St. Petersburg and Chile in Moscow. So how was the experience overall, first off, and then we'll get into sort of specifics as we go through it?
Yeah, it was a very interesting experience. Not having been to Russia, it wasn't the easiest, travel experience. You compare it, to the rest of Europe. Language is obviously an issue, but yeah. In saying that, everything was relatively smoothly. The stadiums are, pretty nice and shiny. A lot of security, as you can imagine, in this sort of climate around the world.
Yep.
It was pretty well run. And I think those fans, obviously, granted that the Socceroos qualify for the World Cup, as we all hope, those fans who do decide to go, I don't think they should be too wary about going to Russia. It'll be a very different World Cup to Brazil and South Africa and Germany. Obviously, I was at the Brazil one, and that was fantastic. But I don't think it wouldn't necessarily be as good. Just a different and a unique experience.
How was actually getting into Russia? Was it difficult applying for? Was it a long wait time applying for visas? Could you apply for a visa on entry? What was the transport like? Is it going to be difficult for fans to get around the country?
Well, with the FIFA accreditation, the visa process was really easy. Just going to the visa office here, and there was two actually in the UK, Manchester and London, and so that was quite sort of. I think what I understand for fans, they have actually like a fans ID process, so you actually get an ID for the tournament, and that's pretty straightforward and very easy. So once you've got that, you're sorted. So I think they're also, in terms of transport, they're putting on, if you've got a ticket between games, say, between Moscow and St. Petersburg, which I think is only about an hour and a half flight, but about maybe 5 hours on the train, they've actually put on free train travel.
Oh, okay.
They're definitely, making accommodations for fans. And obviously Russia is a massive country, so it really depends. I think the talk is that the Socceroos are going to be based in Kazan if they qualify, but where they play their games, the group games, is obviously... And we won't know that until the draw is made, which I think is generally around December this year. But they'll probably fly in and out. And planes, I think Russia's pretty good compared to, say, Brazil in terms of the train network. But also there's a lot of flights. I think Moscow's got four airports.
Yep.
So it was very easy going from St. Petersburg to Moscow and then getting out of Moscow. Probably more issues around some of the other cities like Sochi,
yep.
Which is apparently the Gold Coast of Russia, so it's deemed on the Black Sea.
Not necessarily a good thing.
bit of a resort town, but obviously they had the Olympics there, so they've got a whole sort of, like in Sydney, an Olympic park set up, which is brand spanking new, because I think the Olympics were the last year, if I'm right there. I think transport-wise, not a big issue. Really, language is probably the only thing. English isn't spoken much at all.
Yep.
So that can be a bit of a spanner in the works, but definitely worth the effort if you can get to Russia, I'd say.
And what about the stuff organised around the games? Was it easy getting finding where the stadium was? Do they have volunteers directing people? What was the local life around the stadiums in the lead up to the games? Were there places fans could go for a drink and all that sort of gear?
Different sort of setups. I mean, in Moscow, it was connected to the metro network, so that was really easy to get to. Obviously, Moscow's a sprawling metropolis, so it really depends where, in the city you are, but connected by train. The Petersburg, the stadium is a bit out of the city, and it was there was a metro station nearby, but the security in terms of getting a taxi there, which is what I did, it was a really, you had to walk a couple of miles in, so... not a huge amount at the stadiums, but I mean, there's generally all the sponsor stuff, Coca-Cola tents, and
yep.
I think it'd probably be Budweiser maybe the main sponsors or all that sort of stuff. And weirdly enough, on both the games that I went to, they had mimes sort of operating in the outsides of the stadium.
Interesting.
Which was weird. Yeah. I didn't really know what to say that. But, they're definitely trying to make the it's as accommodating as possible. There are a lot of volunteers who speak English at the stadium, so that's not an issue. And they're friendly and all that sort of stuff. And obviously, there wasn't much of an atmosphere at the Cameroon Australia game. The teams and being in St. Petersburg, but for Chile in Australia in Moscow, there was quite a big Chilean contingent, and they had the band out and a lot of colour and noise. So that was great. So obviously, it's a Confederations Cup, not a World Cup, so you'd be expecting, full houses and much bigger atmospheres in 12 months' time.
Yep, definitely. And just the final point before we get into the soccer, or the final question before we get into the Socceroos side of things. How did you find the stadiums themselves? Obviously, they picked the best sort of stadiums that were already ready. Obviously, there's been talk about, I don't think it was a St. Petersburg, it might have been the one we played on. It was definitely one of the ones that were played on in the first couple of games. Might have been Kazan, I'm not sure, but the stadium having huge problems with the pitches that were being laid, they were running late and over budget. How did you find the stadiums themselves? Were they all finished, and were they built? What was the build like, and were they a good viewing experience, all that sort of thing?
Yeah, the one in St. Petersburg, I think, finished last year. It's the one that took 10 years to build and cost $1 billion.
Yep.
And as a cabbie told me on the way in, I think the Japanese architect who designed it died before it was built.
Oh God!
So it was a bit of a nightmare to finish, but it is it's a lovely stadium. It's probably about 97-98%. There's still a couple of dry paint and that sort of thing. But I mean, looking at Brazil, the stadiums weren't finished when the tournament was actually on, so there's still
true.
Time to finish that. But yeah, it was massive. I think probably 70,000 or more. Very nice, and the Spartak Stadium in Moscow. That was opened in, I think, 2014, and about 45,000, and it was wonderful. That was for the Chile Socceroos game, and a bit more compact, obviously. The other one was quite cavernous, but fantastic setup. Everything ran well, and I haven't obviously seen the other ones, and I think there'll generally be about 10 host cities, so it'd be interesting to see whether they're building. These ones were both pretty new, 1 year and 3 years old, so investing a lot of money in getting these stadiums right.
All right, nice one. So we'll get into specifics about the Socceroos now. We'll chat about the games individually in a minute, but overall, how did you see the campaign from the Socceroos?
I think it ended in a positive note, and we can sort of look perhaps more positively than going in. I thought going in, there was the 4-0 loss to Brazil. There was, some... mediocre performances against Saudi Arabia, even though we won, and against Iraq in Iran, the 1-1 draw.
Yep.
I wasn't particularly confident going into the tournament, and I think the first game, the German team did win the tournament, so the Socceroos started really badly, but to their credit, they picked up their game in the second half and did quite well, and it finished 3-2. So that wasn't necessarily a bad result. I think the 1-1 draw with Cameroon was very disappointing. I was at that game, and the Socceroos were talking it up after the game, saying they should have won and they dominated large parts of the game. And while they did dominate possession and they held the ball well, I think it was the shot count was something like 19-5.
Yep.
And Cameroon really should have won the game. Their finishing was woeful. They had chance after chance to score and just didn't put them away. And that was really disappointing because I think... that's the game that Socceroos had to win. It was the easiest game of the group. They had to win that game and have any chance of progressing. And ultimately, if they'd won that and drawn with Chile, they might have... Well, no, I don't think actually they wouldn't have gone through, but they would have had a much better chance, obviously.
Yep.
So that was disappointing. But, they stuck to, I guess, the principles that Ange Postecoglou wants them to play. Possession football, the pressing, and even though the sort of the counter-attacking game of Cameroon, they really struggled to contain with that, and the athleticism of the Cameroon players and the speed with the, I guess, against the three-man back line, which has been so controversial. And then, going into the Chile game, I was quite pessimistic. Look at Chile. South American champions, I think ranked fourth in the world.
And the starting the players line, and got. The starting lineup, whether I think if people were even more pessimistic once they saw the team that he actually picked.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that caught everyone, the Australian media who were on the ground there, all by surprise. Six changes, leaving out Rogic and Moy. But I guess the thing to consider was the massively short turnaround.
Yep.
This you know, there was three games in 7 days, which usually I think in the World Cup there's four or five days between each game. So it was a really quick turnaround, a long season, coming at the end of a long season, particularly for the likes of Aaron Moy, who played probably more than 60 games.
Yeah.
He ran the changes, and I think that was a key factor, particularly the likes of Troisi and Luongo and Irvine, how they played. We saw Timmy Cahill starting, which has been a long time since he started, but the Socceroos were just brilliant against Chile. Really unlucky not to win that game. So many chances, such a positive performance, and really surprised the Chileans, I think, and surprised a lot of people around the world. So I think, finishing with 2 points, two draws and a loss, there is plenty to take on to Japan, and it's one of those things the Socceroos have been saying for a while. You know, when our performances click, we get everything right, we're going to really, beat a big team and sort of show everyone. And while they didn't beat Chile, I guess the performance wasn't 100% right, it was probably 90% right, and it was really impressive. Ange was probably coming in for a lot of criticism before that game, but that performance against Chile was probably one of the best in his 4 years in charge of the Socceroos, in my opinion, taking away from the Asian Cup. And it was everything sort of that he wanted in terms of, beating one of the best teams in the world. Taking it too,
yeah.
and for large parts dominating one of the best teams in the world.
Well, it was certainly a marked turnaround, I thought, in the mentality of the style of play. We were still playing the pressing game, but we were a lot more physical. We were up in the face of the Chileans, and that sort of hearkening back to how we used to play. I think that was why we were so successful at the 2006 World Cup. Do you think Ange sort of stumbled on that sort of by accident, mainly because he had, like you mentioned before, he had to make those changes, and he basically thought, well, because I've not got the luxury players on the pitch that I'd picked in the first two games, these ones we've got the more physical players, this style is going to suit them. Do you think we should probably be mixing and matching that a little bit more? Obviously, we've had this poor run of sort of fairly mediocre performances and results, as you mentioned. Do you think maybe Moy and Rogic are more luxury players that, similar to how England tend to underperform but always seem to pick Gerrard and Lampard in the middle of the park and it just never really worked? Do you think that maybe Ange sort of stumbled on a formula that we might be able to look to capitalise on going forward?
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think definitely there was, more of a performance in keeping with the traditions of Australian football, and we've always essentially been a physical country. That's just the way that the game's played in our country, and we've always been usually athletic and big and strong. And we definitely saw, in the Cameroon game, we got a bit muscled off the ball at times and dominated in those, one-on-one challenges. And against Chile, we really, there was a bit of fear of God there. Mm. I think we had three yellow cards after 30 minutes. And I think, in an ideal world, and the best teams do it, you've got to marry the physical with the technical side. And we definitely did that against Chile. We haven't always done that in other games. But, yeah, I think for us to be successful, we can't necessarily outplay on the technical side every team in the world. But, you need to win the ball and then you need to, know what to do when you've got it.
Yep.
And there was definitely a marked change in terms of the physicality. And I guess that's something for Ange to sort is we're very strong in that midfield, but without Mille Jedinak, who was unavailable, and I guess with the defence, not really a lot of depth there. Mark Milligan was amazing against Alexis Sanchez in that game, dropping back. He doesn't want to play there, but
I think he has to play there, unless we can find somebody to take that spot, because Degenek and Bailey Wright haven't really impressed in the inner back three.
No, they seem to struggle in the back three. Trent Sainsbury, I thought, was very good.
Yep.
But, yeah, we need a player who's very comfortable on the ball there, or two players along with Sainsbury. And obviously Matt Sparanovic would suit that, but he was injured. And, Milligan was great in that role. And I guess that allowed Luongo and Irvine, who are, if you compare them probably to Moy and maybe some of the other players available, a bit more direct. you know, a bit more physical. And I think Jackson Irvine definitely, and they really had a point to prove, and they've had great games against Chile. So it'll be interesting to see how he goes on that and how he uses his squad. I think one of Ange's big things he's always talking about, which is you see how many players he's used in the 4 years, is creating depth. Yeah. And I think there's probably maybe 60 players or more that he's capped in his time in charge of the national team. So definitely having those options to you know, for different opposition, I think is very smart. But yeah, marrying that physical and the skillful side, the technical side is what we need to going forward. Because obviously with someone like Japan, who you know, technically they're probably superior man by man than Australia,
yep.
But generally they're not going to have the strength in each position or the height or the physicality. So if we can marry those two together, you know, I think that, you know, we can get a win in Japan, which I don't think we've done for many years.
Yeah, a long time. I suppose, yeah. one of the final points, can you see, obviously, out of necessity, we dropped Luongo, and sorry, not Luongo, Moy and Rogic, out of that, being more highly regarded players. Can you see us still using the way we played against Chile? Can you see that working against Japan if we have Moy and Rogic? Because they're not really the sort of players. Maybe Rogic. I mean, obviously Scotland's a more physical league, but can you see those two players being able to play that way when they come back into the team? Or do you think that maybe we'd maybe need to look to adjust? Angel look to adjust the style again if he wants to bring those two back in.
Yeah, I think it's really got a dilemma there, how to fit those two in. I don't know if you can sort of have them, if you want to play that high-pressing, intensity sort of game, have both of them in the lineup, particularly if you're going to have them sort of as the two tens or the two attacking midfielders and then have the two holders behind them. I think, personally, I think Aaron Moy is best positioned, as he showed at Huddersfield this season, as a six,
yeah.
As a defensive midfielder. Obviously, he made his name at Melbourne City as a ten, but I don't think he's got necessarily the pace at the international level to be a 10 or a successful 10, but that's just my personal opinion. Yeah, it's hard with Yannanak coming back, Milligan in there as well, and then you've got Luongo, who was, you know, had a disappointing performance against Germany, but geez, he was awesome against Chile. It was, yeah, back to his Asian Cup form. So it is hard to see what he does there, because he can't, and I think he's one of the things he's tried to do with this three-man defence is fit, you know, some of his midfield talent all into the formation, but it hasn't really clicked much. So, yeah, where he goes from there, it's hard to know. But, yeah, I think there's some hard decisions in terms of who starts and maybe who comes on as an impact player. I mean, bringing, you know, Rogic or Moy off the bench is not necessarily a bad option if you've got 30 minutes left and you need to score or create a goal. And I think Tommy Juric also, I thought he was particularly good. I thought he was good against Saudi Arabia. He got two goals, and I think he's sort of going into that target man role as well.
Yep.
So it's good to see another option up front that we have.
Yeah, and I thought Troisi also put his hand up in that Chile game and stood out a lot. It's been interesting to see if he ends up getting an offer from Europe. But yeah, there's definitely some developments in that. So last question, I suppose. Does that Chile game give you a lot more hope for our final two World Cup qualifiers against Japan and then Thailand at home?
Yeah, it definitely does. I think before that game, I was starting to get quite concerned,
yeah,
and think, you know, well, maybe Ian's just taken the team as far as he could. Maybe he's, you know, he's very steadfast and determined in his style and his philosophy, but maybe it was a time to be a bit more pragmatic, I guess, depending on the opposition, you know, if you're playing Germany, Brazil, as opposed to Iraq and the UAE. But no, I think it sort of shows that his hard work and all the time he's had it is paying off, and you know, there's a lot of promising signs there. So still, the game against Japan is obviously massive. If they can win that game, I think Thailand in Australia should be a, you know, reasonably comfortable victory. And then that gives the Socceroos a massive chance of finishing that top two. Otherwise, it's third place in a playoff, which, you know, still very possible that they would qualify, but a much difficult route than, you know, going straight through. So that August 30 game is going to be really interesting. And obviously Japan dropping 2 points with their draw against Iraq. So that no one really saw that coming
no,
either. So
no.
It's set up sort of nicely, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's certainly going to be interesting to watch over the next couple of months. So we'll finish off this chat with a little bit of Jet stuff just before we let you go. Obviously, the players are back for their second week of preseason training. How have you seen the off-season developing? Obviously, we've signed quite a bunch of players and quite a few that I didn't we mentioned it in the podcast that came out a couple of days ago. The signings of Glenn Moss and Nikolai Topor-Stanley weren't really talked about before they were announced. They were quite a surprise to quite a lot of us that they didn't even come out that we were talking to them. So how have you seen the squad rebuild developing from over there?
Yeah, I think they've done reasonably well. You're right, though. It's been sort of, I guess, more low key compared to, you know, a few of the other clubs. But I think Glenn Moss could be a very good signing. He's always been a very, you know, solid keeper. He's experienced. Obviously, Jack Duncan's a lot younger, but you really need competition in those spots. And obviously, Jack Duncan didn't have that last year. So I think that's a good signing. Obviously, Ernie Merrick knows him very well from his time at Wellington. And, yeah. And Topor Stanley, I guess, is more of an interesting one because, I think he was great at the Jets at his first stint. You know, very unlucky that the Jets, you know, or unfortunate that they lost him. And then, you know, he had that great success at Western Sydney. But he did seem, just before he left to go overseas to Asia, he did seem like, you know, he was on the downward spiral.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not really sure how much he can give. But, I mean, you know, he is a leader. If he can, you know, if he's got a bit more left in the tank, I think central defence has definitely been an issue for the Jets the last couple of seasons. So they definitely needed a central defender, and he fits that bill. So hopefully he can get back to that Western Sydney form. You know, that'll be great to see. And then, you know, there's been some other Petrados obviously coming was really surprising. He was in Korea for about 5 minutes.
Yep, yep. We did some good business there. News.
Yeah, great news for the Jets. I mean, both Dimi and Costa, you know, young, talented, attacking players. You know, I think, you know, with Dimi there, Wayne Brown, you've got essentially, you know, two tens. It'd be interesting to see how he's going to sort of fit in, or how Ernie wants to see all this fit in with Nibu there as well, and Roy O'Donovan, and Mario Chabau coming as well.
Yep.
From Western Sydney. So there's been some positive signs. I still think they're, you know, another, you know, two players, the next two players are really, really crucial to see who they bring in. But it's looking like, in my opinion, a better squad than last season, which, you know, needed to be. But I guess the other question mark is Coco. From what I understand, his agent hasn't gone back to me, but I think he's staying,
yep.
Which I don't know is necessarily a good or a bad thing because he was, you know, such a disappointment last year. Obviously, he was injured, but, you know, the Jets can't afford to have one of their visa players just not performing. Just, yeah, can't have that.
No.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting. But then you look at some of the other clubs, for example, just down the road, the Mariners, I think they've strengthened particularly well. So it's not going to be any easier next season.
No. Well, it's certainly going to be interesting. And obviously the other important side of things from the obviously player recruitment is important, but it was important to get the right manager in, and we haven't spoken to you for a while. So what were your thoughts on the appointment of Ernie Merrick? Obviously the Jets went away from their policy over the last couple of seasons of appointing a first-time coach, someone who people that had been had not had the senior job before, so taking a punt on a new bloke hadn't really paid off for us the last couple of times. So I personally, and what we discussed was we thought that the appointment of Ernie was pretty much nailed on. Laurie needed to get the appointment right, and appointing somebody senior with senior experience, a lot of experience, and had actually won stuff before was fairly important.
Yeah, I mean, I just going back to Mark Jones, I thought he was the wrong choice initially, and you know they did start reasonably well, and I was, you know, happy to be proved wrong, but obviously everything fell apart. Yeah. And yeah, I think they needed to go to a proven manager. Before that, obviously, Scott Miller and Stubbins, they needed to go to an experienced manager. And Ernie Merrick definitely is that. He won the A-League numerous times with Victory, but on the flip side of that, hasn't had a great run in Wellington of late. And I guess there is a few questions about whether at his age he's still got the motivation, the enthusiasm to do the job. I personally would have liked to have seen someone like a Gombau. I just think he... I mean, whether they could have got him from the FFA is another question, but I just think he would be perfect. Not only the style that his teams play, his record at developing young players, but he's proven at Adelaide. Obviously, I think he won the FFA Cup there, and also the team essentially that he built, the players that he recruited, likes of SAS and Theriault and those players, they went on to win the double. Not last season, the season before there, he laid the platform for that team, and he's also, done it in Asia. So I think he would have been my ideal choice, but, I really hope I'm wrong and he does well. He's definitely had success in the past, and he's got a decent record. It's just the last couple of seasons, the Wellington haven't performed, and I know, speaking to Ernie, in pre-season last year, after they played the Mariners in Bucker College, I think it was, and he basically said, if they didn't make the top four with the team they had at Wellington, that it'd be a failure. And I think he was out of there by January. I could be wrong. And they had a very good squad. They just didn't perform. So, I really hope that this is the right choice. And obviously, Laurie McKenna has thrown his lot in with Ernie.
Yep.
So, if it doesn't work out, it's not going to reflect well on him. But, I really hope it's the right choice. And I guess we keep saying it every year, don't we?
Yeah.
It's a critical season.
Well, it is a critical season, but it's even more critical now. All right, one more question to wrap it up with before we let you go. Obviously, we've got the first game coming up the first big game. We've got a couple of trial games against NPL opposition before we lead into the FFA Cup game against Adelaide away. That's been announced for the 9th of August. Obviously, Adelaide are missing an absolute boatload of people and have only just brought in a new manager. Probably the best time to face a club like Adelaide.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we always play an A League team, don't we? And we've never gotten past the first round, essentially, when the A League clubs come in. So it'd be great to see a cup run. I'm not necessarily saying the Jets need to win it, but geez, it'd be good to at least get past the first round and progress. And I think you're 100% right there. It's a perfect time to face Adelaide. They've only just appointed their coach, who by the sounds of it has a decent pedigree, but they've lost a lot of players. A lot of players left, gone overseas. Dylan McGowan, Galekovic has gone to Melbourne City, and they're still in the process of recruiting.
Yep.
So I think Karoska might have gone as well. There's a bit of a doubt over
Riley McGree's just departed to Club Brugge as well.
Today actually he's just going to Club Brugge. So it's a great time to really face them. So I think, they've just come off a horrendous season as well. So it is actually a good time to face them. Maybe the away trip will help. I think doing well in the FFA Cup would be massive for the club, and also help Ernie as well. I think if you could, have a good cup run, that's only going to do well for the fans, for the club, and I guess inject a bit of confidence in the community, in the club, because, geez, it's definitely needed, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely right. All right, mate. Well, we really appreciate you making your time available, and thanks very much for coming on.
No worries. Thanks for having me. I'm down, Benjamin.